Blog Talk Radio.
Walk up, bitch. Man, it was weird. Like, yes, right when I got off air, my throat was killing me. It was so random. It was that feeling, like, you know that stuff, chloroseptic, that you, like, numb your throat with? My doctor said I shouldn't use it, but I used it anyway because it was just, my throat was hurting so much that I needed to numb it. I wish I had cocaine. I would have rubbed cocaine all over the back of my throat so it would have numbed it in a better way. And so I go to sleep, I wake up this morning, same fucking thing. I'm like, God damn it, I could barely talk this morning. And I was like, well, I'm going to do a full show prep and, you know, just hope that I have a voice by the time the show comes around. Weirdest fucking thing, after like an hour after I woke up, it was fine. My voice was fine. And my throat didn't even hurt anymore. I was like, what the fuck? I don't know, man, some weird shit going on. You know, I probably have 43 medical issues that I'm unaware of. But with that being said, with that super random beginning, I have a great show for you guys today. A lot of really interesting stuff to get to. So I'm going to prove to you that Jeb Bush is a criminal, and I'm going to do that right up front here. It's going to be the first story. And by the time I'm done explaining it to you, you're going to realize, oh, yeah, it's not even like a debatable thing. Like, the dude is a criminal, and he just has not been prosecuted. So we'll talk about that. We also have Ron Paul goes on Larry King's internet show, and he makes a really interesting point about just how screwed up the presidential debate system is. So we'll talk about that. We have, oh, my God, Lindsey Graham. I've been going after Lindsey Graham pretty aggressively over the past few shows. He made what may be the dumbest foreign policy proposal I've ever heard. And somehow in like a 2-minute clip, he managed to squeeze in everything you could ever think of that's dead wrong about how we should use American military power around the world. We'll discuss that. Obama kind of, sort of, a little bit goes after Netanyahu. A little bit. I mean, the thing is, he goes after Netanyahu as much as is seemingly possible within the context of U.S. politics. Because, as you know, every single presidential candidate or president has to hold hands with Israel and sing Kumbaya and talk about puppies and rainbows. You're not allowed to get serious. Obama's kind of starting to inch a little bit more in the serious direction, so we'll talk about that. Rick Perry shoves his foot in his mouth, so I will shove my foot in his ass. I like that juxtaposition. I'm going to use that more often. Rick Santorum also shoves his foot in his mouth, so I will shove my foot in his ass. He actually might enjoy that because he might like things in his ass. Rush Limbaugh went on a hilarious and disgusting rant about Caitlyn Jenner. We'll talk about that. I just got so much stuff. Demons. I have two separate stories in today's show that involve demons. So how are you going to miss that, man? You can't miss a conversation about demons. You'd be crazy to miss that. All right, anyway, let's get started and kick it off here with Jeb Bush. The New York Times has a great article out today exposing how Jeb Bush is basically a brazen criminal who's rubbing it in all of our faces. So it's been widely understood for a while now that Jeb Bush is going to run for president, but he hasn't officially announced yet. Now, you might think that's strange, but he's waiting for a cynical reason and a criminal reason. So the New York Times reports, quote, lawyers say Mr. Bush is stretching the limits of election law by crisscrossing the country, hiring a political team, and raising tens of millions of dollars at fundraisers, all without declaring. All right, so the issue is, once you announce, the few remaining campaign finance laws apply to you. So individuals and corporations can now give nearly unlimited donations to super PACs and to parties and to causes, but they cannot give unlimited donations to individual candidates. So that's why Jeb is doing what he's doing right now and not declaring yet. He wants the, you know, unlimited donations to go in all areas. They say, quote, if Mr. Bush did declare that he is running, it would bring election restrictions, including a limit of $2,700 on contributions and a ban on coordinating with a super PAC, which he's using to raise money. So again, as of right now, because he hasn't declared yet, he can basically raise money and have no limits in any area, and he's coordinating with his super PAC. Now, his super PAC is going to be aggressive in trying to get him elected, of course, but the second that he announces that he's running, he's not allowed to have any contact with them whatsoever, because by law, what a super PAC is a group that's advocating for a candidate or a cause, but it's not connected to the person. So you try to basically prevent corruption by doing something like that. Again, Jeb's workaround is, I'm just not going to announce, and I'll work with my super PAC, and I'll have unlimited donations in every area. All right, so let's get into more detail here. Why isn't he announcing for other reasons here? Well, he wants to continue to take the unlimited donations, and he realizes that it's going to be illegal once he declares that he's in. Okay, now, if he was convicted of this, it's a form of corruption, right? So perhaps what would the consequences be? He would be barred from running for office. Perhaps he goes to jail. You know, this is serious stuff here. They say in the article, quote, for a candidate to avoid restrictions by simply not declaring his candidacy makes a mockery of the law. How good of a case is there against Jeb? So I laid out some basic facts here for you. I gave you the framework of the story, but how good is the case against him? Quote, some election experts say Mr. Bush passed the legal threshold to be considered a candidate months ago, even if he has not formally acknowledged it. Federal law makes anyone who raises or spends $5,000 in an effort to become president a candidate and thus subject to the spending and disclosure restrictions. Okay, so he already did that. This is an open and shut case. Charge him. He's guilty. They just say, under the law, if you raise or spend $5,000 in an effort to become president, well, then you're officially subject to these laws, and it's as if you already announced that you're running. All right, that's it. I don't know why we're sitting here having a conversation anymore. But if that's not enough for you, it gets better. Quote, this is one of the things that he said recently. I really like campaigning, Mr. Bush told businessmen in Portsmouth, New Hampshire last month before quickly adding, but I'm not a candidate. So do you see what he did there? He said, I really, really love campaigning. It's great. Wait, what? Oh, I didn't announce yet? Oh, that was a Freudian slip. I mean, I'm not a candidate, something. What? So also last month, he slipped up in a more brazen way, and he told reporters in Nevada, quote, I am running for president in 2016. All right, so understand what's happening here. You have a guy who's just overtly breaking the few campaign finance laws we have left. You have a guy who admitted at a certain point, yeah, no, I'm running for president in 2016. And what's been done in response to it? Crickets. I hear absolutely nothing. So, I mean, come on, though. This is the most evidence humanly possible. We have the clearest case ever of somebody violating the few remaining election laws that we have left. So the Federal Elections Commission has to step in, right? I mean, this is why they exist. Ready for this? Quote, the FEC, perpetually gridlocked, was unlikely to do anything. All right, here's what I need you to understand. There are no regulation laws left for campaigns in America in any way. The ones that are left on the books are just symbolic. Now, we already have a situation where, you know, we have very few laws remaining. But even those laws aren't enforced. And guess what? It was by design. You know, there was another article that we covered recently which goes into detail and explains how the FEC was set up for this reason. The FEC was set up to have perpetual gridlock. You lock up the Democrats and the Republicans on the panel, so anytime a Republican wants to go after a Democrat for breaking election law, the Democrats will block it, and anytime the Democrats want to go after a Republican for breaking an election law, the Republicans will block it. So at the end of the day, anybody can do anything and raise any amount of money in any area, and it's totally fine. So we have a system in America that is basically an open oligarchy today. There's a reason why all the billionaires and the corporations are giving money to the politicians, and it's because they get favors in return. And this is why that Princeton study said what you and I think is irrelevant, what the middle class and the poor thinks. It's irrelevant. We have zero effect on policy. And this story is explaining to you, here's a guy who could fucking be forced not to run based off of what he's doing, or he could end up in jail because what he's doing is corruption. And what's being done? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Guys, the system in America is a joke, man. I mean, I don't know what else to say about this other than if I had to sit down and write up a fake story about a made-up candidate who is violating these election laws and should be punished, if I had to sit down and write that out, it would be this story. It would be a story about a guy who slipped up. He said he's running multiple times, a guy who's made clear he's going to run, but he's still raising money and coordinating with his super PAC and ignoring all limits. I would write up the story of Jeb Bush. And by the way, Jeb Bush also has, you know, endless quotes that are mentioned in the article here where he's like, oh, no, me, I would never violate election law. Bob Schieffer asked him recently. He was appalled that that Bob Schieffer asked him. He's like, oh, how dare you question my integrity? Bitch, look at what you're doing. Look at what your actions say. I don't give a fuck about who you think you are and what you want us to think about you. Your actions matter, and you're violating election law. Look, man, it's sick. I'm so tired of the Clintons. I'm so tired of the Bushes. I'm so tired of the establishment corporatist families. We got to stop with this nonsense, man. We got to get these clowns out of power. Don't you dare even consider, under any circumstance, supporting Jeb Bush or, you know, even believing that he's some sort of principled conservative. He is no such thing. He is the poster boy of corruption and, you know, the American establishment and corporatism. He's the poster boy of a billionaire sellout. All right, am I clear? All right, now I'm going to go to Ron Paul. See, we've been talking about Rand Paul so much, I can't even say Ron anymore. Same issue here, elections. Ron Paul went on Larry King's internet show, and he made an interesting point about how the presidential debates are run, and I want to expand on this.
Fox News is hosting the first presidential debate among the Republicans. It's going to restrict the number of participants. Contenders have to place in the top 10 in 5 major national polls to participate. What do you think of that?
I don't like the debate process. You know, in 07, when Fox was holding the first one, about 2 days before it was being held, and I was doing very well in the polls, they just uninvited me, you know, which was, you know, as far as the campaign goes, it wasn't very helpful. So, no, I think there has to be a better way of choosing. I mean, it's sort of like, why do the candidates roll over, you know, and abide by the rules of some commercial organization that has an agenda? And, you know, Fox certainly has a very powerful agenda. So who knows of the rating? I know that even on their polling after debates, I usually won all the polling,
yeah.
But they say, well, there's a mistake, and they would ignore it. So, no, I don't like the idea that somebody like Fox has sort of monopoly control over how a debate will be run.
That is true. We covered some of those stories at the time. You would have Ron Paul come in second in a straw poll, or, you know, there would be some sort of evidence that he's gaining popularity and that he's threatening the people at the top who are expected to win. And you would have just a media blackout across the board, almost as if they got together in a back room and they were like, nobody mentioned Ron Paul. And look, I don't think it's a grand conspiracy or anything like that, but it does show you something about corporate media culture, how they have these impressions and they have these biases, and they might not even realize it, but they express them on air. So if you're around people who always say that Ron Paul is not a serious candidate, then you're willing to dismiss the evidence that he is a serious candidate. You're willing to just gloss over him and act like he's totally irrelevant, even though he was one of the only people on the right, if not the only person on the right, who actually had any decent ideas on any issues. And here's the thing, man, that you need to understand. The reason why he's treated like a buffoon and there were media blackouts of him and they tried to exclude him from debates is that he threatens the establishment. He threatens the corporatocracy. So they want him out. Now, it goes without saying, everybody already knows, I don't agree with Ron Paul on everything. I probably only agree with him on 40% or 50% of the issues. But the thing is, anytime you have somebody who's voicing an opinion that's out of the mainstream and out of what's considered normal within the elite, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to cover it. And they're so willing and ready to just dismiss this guy. So when you have somebody like Ron Paul, who's a true capitalist, where he says, I'm in favor of small government. I don't even want corporate welfare. I wouldn't have bailed out the banks. I wouldn't have helped Wall Street. When you have somebody say something like that, all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, shit. No, we can't give him as much coverage because, oh, fringe loon and our buddies in corporate America wouldn't like that if you had this guy voicing unpopular opinions to them. So, okay, let's not treat him as a serious candidate like Mitt Romney, who's a ridiculous human being. Now, also understand, the way the debates used to be done, I believe it was run by the League of Women Voters, so it was like this independent third-party thing here that stepped in and tried to be as fair as possible in having the debates. Over time, that changed, and now the debates are run by the Democratic and the Republican parties. So the leadership of the parties run the debates, and they exclude whoever the fuck they want to exclude. So they're working together to silence any third-party people or any Democrats or Republicans they don't like. And, of course, they get their funding from giant corporations and from billionaires. So what you've set up is a system where they tweak the rules on purpose to try to limit debate, to try to, you know, weed out the people who are not going to toe the line and continue the status quo and do business as usual. We always talk about how there are ayatollahs in Iran that you have to be vetted by them before you, can be considered an acceptable candidate to then run. We have our version of that. For us, it's the heads of the major corporations. It's the ownership class. It's the billionaire class. They're the ones who own the parties, who run the parties, and they're the ones who run the debates, so they're just going to exclude people who they don't like. You saw it with Ron Paul. They're certainly going to do it on the left with people like Bernie Sanders and anybody who's significantly more progressive than Hillary Clinton. And it's incumbent upon people like us to step up and say, whoa, 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 you can't do that. You can't do that. You know, these people need to be heard. These people need to – if anything, you know what it is? You have to focus on their ideas because, as we all know, corporate media is going to focus on what? Personality. They're going to try to turn it into a reality show. They're going to try to turn it into a popularity contest. They're not going to focus on issues. They're not going to focus on policies. And, of course, if when it comes to policy, on the right, the best representatives you have of a genuine ideology would be somebody like Ron Paul or Rand Paul. And on the left, it's somebody like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. The media will do everything that they can, and the establishment will do everything they can to steer that in the other direction and steer it towards the Jeb Bush side on the Republicans and the Hillary Clinton side for the Democrats. We can't let it happen, man. We got to fight back, and we got to have guys like this have their voices heard. All right, now. Let me do one more here before we take our first break, and this one will be on Syria. And I'm going to tell you how the Constitution is now optional in America. Sad state of affairs. Yesterday, a House committee decided to send a message to the Senate and the President on the issue of Syria. Lawmakers added a provision to the 2016 defense spending bill stating that, quote, Congress has a constitutional duty to debate and determine whether or not to authorize the use of military force. So, in other words, they're saying, all of you need to get your shit together. We've been at war with Syria for 10 months, and you still haven't declared war. You can't do that. So the provision was written by Representative Barbara Lee, and understand that it isn't enforceable, but it's basically a snarky way of prodding the Senate to do the right thing, to have the debate and to have the vote. So here's what Representative Lee said, quote, We must recognize that Congress has an important role to play in matters of war and peace. It's way past time to reassert Congress's role in war making. We can't allow this policy of endless war to continue. This amendment just says Congress has a constitutional duty to debate and determine whether to use military force against ISIS. A debate, doing our job. That's all this amendment requires. Now here's my favorite part of the article in Huffington Post. They say, quote, Lee's amendment passed 29-22. Okay, so that's good. Its passage seemed to surprise the committee chairman, Representative Hal Rogers, who's a Republican of Kentucky, who initially held a voice vote and said that the amendment failed. Lee requested a record vote afterward, and it passed. So understand the irony there. We're at a point now in America where congressmen are surprised by a provision that tries to get the Senate to abide by the Constitution. And also a Republican's like, oh, this crazy amendment couldn't have passed. I don't believe it. Wait a second. You guys are the party that always screams from the rooftops about the Constitution and how it's not debatable. We're here. Well, here you have an amendment where all they're saying is, can we just follow the Constitution when it comes to war? And you're like, oh, crazy loony dudes, lefty. It doesn't make any sense. What do you mean follow the Constitution? It's like we're living in the Twilight Zone. So if you haven't kept track of it up to this point, we've been fighting in Syria for 10 months. We spent more than $2.1 billion during that time span. We participated in more than 4,000 airstrikes, and we sent 3,000 men to the ground in Syria and Iraq. They say, no, it's not boots on the ground, though. It's not combat troops. It's just to help and do intelligence stuff and to train people. Right, 3,000 boots on the ground doesn't count as boots on the ground. I know. If China sent 3,000 to Alabama, we totally flip on that and say, what do you mean? They're not there to do war. But when we do it to other people, no, it doesn't count. That's not war. I know, the same way we're not doing war when we drone people in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. That's not war. We're just doing drones. What are you talking about? That's not war. So, again, if Iran started droning Mississippi, would we say, it's not an all-out war. Come on, guys. Let's be serious here. I love our double standards that are just built into the system. But even with all of those things that we've done, the Senate hasn't even voted on it yet. And I'll tell you why they're doing this. The Republicans want to be able to blame the Democrats when the intervention in Syria fails. That's why they don't want to vote on it. They don't want to have their name associated with a failure of an intervention. But then also, the Democrats and Obama don't want to officially declare a war on their watch because then they started a war. Obama doesn't want to have that on his record that he went to war with Syria. So not declaring war is something that both sides in this case like. But again, here's the problem. That's unconstitutional! So the main issue is, look at the precedent you're setting, man. Putting aside the fact that this intervention isn't going to work, this intervention is dumb, it wastes money, and we could go on and on and on here. But the more important thing is look at the precedent it sets. So now when there's a president, Chris Christie or Paul Ryan or Marco Rubio or Dickface McAssington, the next Republican, now you've set up a system, Obama and the Democrats, where you know, you've now made it debatable as to whether or not a president can just go to war without having any input whatsoever from Congress, any input from the Senate, even though that's what the Constitution says in Article 1, Section 8, under the enumerated powers, you need to get approval from them. Now you've made it so that, no, it's up to the president, they can do whatever the fuck they want. Well then, you know, how far away are we from fascism right now? The president can just go to war, do whatever the fuck they want, no time limits whatsoever, and, you know, nobody says, no, you have to come home. It's a sad thing, man. Unfortunately, with the Democrats and with Obama, we're at this place now where since they call themselves liberal Democrats, they think, well, that means we're the good guys. We're better than the Republicans. So, therefore, if we end up doing Republican-like shit, shut the fuck up and look away. Don't criticize us. Well, you and I both know if it was George Bush in Syria right now, and he's the one who is doing it without any declaration of war, liberals' hair would be on fire, and they'd be screaming, Constitution, 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 Constitution. Well, let's be objective, and let's be fair, and let's say that now when Obama's doing it. It's amazing how the Republicans always scream and yell and bitch and moan about how the Democrats suck and Obama's terrible and rein in his tyranny and all this nonsense on issues like Obamacare and the stimulus where he's not being tyrannical. But in an area where he actually is going to war without declaring a war, there they're like, no, we're with him on that. He can do it and we don't even need to vote on it. When I read this story, my takeaway is apparently our entire system is completely broken. All right, let me take my first break. When we come back, President Obama is finally going to speak out against Benjamin Netanyahu a little bit, and then we got Lindsey Graham, who calls for the worst foreign policy proposal ever. So don't miss any of that. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. But a very, very, very little bit of credit. You'll see why that is. President Obama is finally speaking out against Benjamin Netanyahu after Netanyahu repeatedly spit in his eye. So recently, Netanyahu did an unprecedented speech to Congress without Obama's approval, tank the Iran peace deal, so stay classy there, Netanyahu. And remind me again who the bad guys are, I'm curious. Because you have the Iranians say they're for peace, the Democrats in America say they're for peace, but the Republicans in America are against it, and Netanyahu is against it. So Netanyahu also appointed well-known opponents of a Palestinian state to positions of high authority in his government, including the position of peace negotiator. Sylvan Shalom, who's on the record as being against the Palestinian state, is now the person in charge of negotiations and peace talks to try to get a Palestinian state. So again, this is what I mean when I say Netanyahu's been spitting in Obama's eye. So Obama decided to jab back a little bit. He didn't go balls to the wall here. He didn't throw a haymaker or anything. But what he did is he went on Israeli TV and he said the following, quote, "The danger here is that Israel as a whole loses credibility. Already the international community does not believe that Israel is serious about a two-state solution. It's as if this is simply an effort to return to the previous status quo in which we talk about peace in the abstract, but it's always tomorrow. It's always later." So essentially what he's saying to Netanyahu is, dude, I see through your game. You don't want a Palestinian state. Half the time you say you do, the other half the time you're honest and you say you don't. And I'm kind of tired of doing this game where we run around in circles. So that's not something I wouldn't have expected to hear something like that from Obama, because, you know, up to this point, you get the sense that maybe they disagree with Netanyahu on some things, but publicly it's always like, you know, total blowjobs to Netanyahu. But now he's kind of like, okay, asshole, you know, you went a little too far. And by the way, this may be in the straw that broke the camel's back might have been Shalom getting the position for peace talks. We spoke about that recently. And I said at the time, look, there's no other way to interpret this. Netanyahu is spitting in Obama's eye. So he's probably like, okay, I get it. Now let me fire back a little bit. So Obama also said that Netanyahu's statements following the election had, quote, so many caveats, so many conditions, that it is not realistic to think that those conditions would be met any time in the near future. Yeah, so in other words, I see what Netanyahu is doing. He's saying, yeah, sure, I'm in favor of a Palestinian state, only if I get 100% of what I want and they get 0% of what they want, then yeah, maybe I'll say it's a Palestinian state, slash no, I won't. Obama's recognizing it now, so he says Netanyahu is, quote, predisposed to think of security first, to think perhaps that peace is naive, to see the worst possibilities as opposed to the best possibilities in Arab partners or Palestinian partners. And so I do think that right now those politics and those fears are driving the government's response. So now here's the most important part. Obama said that it would be more, quote, difficult for the U.S. to continue to veto criticisms of Israel at the U.N., argue with those who are concerned about settlement construction, those who are concerned about the current situation. So this is Obama saying, hey, Benjamin, you gone too far, asshole. I mean, we discussed it recently, as Netanyahu at one point was saying, yeah, I'm totally in favor, let's do these peace talks, totally. The next day, you know, we get the news that they just decided to expand settlements and take more Palestinian territory. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, talking out of both sides of your mouth there. Actually, it's not even just that. You're saying one thing, you're doing the exact opposite. So you're totally contradicting yourself. And Obama's saying, dude, we don't even have a logical argument anymore. Do you not realize that? You're saying Palestinians are the bad guys, Palestinians are the bad guys, Palestinians are the bad guys, and here we'll prove that by taking more of their land and by doing offensive incursions into Gaza where we end up killing 60% to 80% civilians. Obama's saying, dude, you can't argue with the people who are saying, you're kind of being a little fucked up to the Palestinians here. So he's wavering a little bit. He's wavering a little bit where he's like, oh, I want to do something to try to get the deal. But look, here's my downer side of the story, and this part, granted, is just my opinion here, but I'm still skeptical that he's going to do anything, okay, because we know the history, we see the history of U.S. presidents and how they react, modern history of U.S. presidents and how they react to leadership in Israel. It's basically across the board, yeah, you get to do whatever the fuck you want, and we got your back, and that's how it works. You can have literally everybody else at the U.N. say, Palestinian state, let's do it. But the U.S. and Israel are like, no! I mean, again, recently we discussed how the Palestinians proposed through Jordan at the U.N. basically the most open-minded peace deal I've ever seen in my life, where they said, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do the 1967 borders. We're going to split up Jerusalem. We're going to basically iron out all the other details, and we'll sit down across the table from each other, and all the specifics that we've left out of this broad deal, let's work it out, and then in a five-year time period, let's enforce it. The most open-minded peace deal you can imagine. They're not asking for right to return. They're not asking for 1947 borders. They're saying 67, and then we'll work everything out. Netanyahu said, not only do I reject it, but the fact that you even proposed it proves that you're anti-Semitic. How do you argue with that? How do you debate that? You can't debate that. He's married to his position, and he doesn't want a Palestinian state. Obama, if you realize it and you really do want a Palestinian state, step the fuck up, son. Grow a pair. Have some balls. Now, granted, no matter what Obama does in this area, if he actually is aggressive, what's going to happen? A lot of people say, oh, he's anti-Semitic. And your response is, yeah, only if anti-Semitic means I want long-term peace for Israel. Because, as I've said time and time again, man, I think, if anything, we are the people who are most pro-Israel. Because if you keep the situation as it is right now, you're making Hamas more popular. That's not my opinion. That's a fact. Netanyahu is Hamas's best friend. After the incursion he did into Gaza recently, Hamas kicked up in popularity over 15 percentage points. So if you actually are in favor of Israel and you want long-term stability and peace in the region, you have to do a deal and you have to do the 1967 borders. And you have to get to that by taking action. Don't just sit there. So here's what you do if you're Obama. You lift the veto at the UN. People will cry and bitch and scream and moan, but you say, look, all you have to do is do the peace deal and then we're back to normal here. You also cut funding. Over $1 billion in aid going to a country that's pretty well off and can handle their own shit doesn't make any sense. Even people who are on the side of Netanyahu have made that argument before, where they say, I don't even know why we're giving them money. It's not necessary, and why should we give them money? Cut the funding, lift the veto with the UN, and yes, you should do sanctions. You absolutely should do sanctions, because guess what? Once you do sanctions, and once people start to feel it, they'll go, all right, where's the 67 borders? Where can I sign? Let's do this right now. And then understand, man, after you get the 67 borders, are there still going to be extremists in Hamas and on the Palestinian side that want right to return and want to continue to attack Israel? Absolutely there's going to be. There's going to be a lot less of them, but those people are still going to exist. So when that happens, guess what? Then the entire world is on your side. The international community is on your side, and they say, all right, you did the peace deal. Some of the people on that side are still attacking. Well, now we're on your side, and now we see that they are the aggressors, and, you know, now we respond accordingly. So it's in every way, shape, and form, the way to go is to do the two-state deal. But Netanyahu is totally against it. Obama's starting to see that Netanyahu is not an honest actor here, and we'll see how he responds. But I'm skeptical that he'll do anything that might actually work in the long run. All right, next. Lindsey Graham. Oh, God. I try to calm myself as we listen to this one here. Take a sip of my water so that I can not lose my voice in the middle of this segment if I happen to start to scream. Presidential candidate Lindsey Graham sat down with Chuck Todd, and he laid out what is quite possibly the worst foreign policy plan ever devised. You don't believe me? Listen.
I were president, the first thing I would announce is I'd arm the Ukrainians so they can fight for their own freedom. I'd leave a residual force behind in Afghanistan, and I would send more troops into Iraq to accelerate their ability to reconstitute their army so they could deny ISIL some safe havens in Iraq. Now, Syria is the hard one. I'd ask Egypt, I'd ask Turkey, and the regional allies we have to form an army, and we'd be part of that army, and we'd go in and take territory back from ISIL, and we'd have to hold it. Then you try to get political reconciliation between the Alawites and the rest of the population in Syria.
How do you get out?
You don't get out.
So that's what you have to set up the country for. So guess what? We're never going to get out. We're going to have to manage the Middle East militarily. I was just going to say,
yeah.
You believe you have to manage it the way we've managed Japan and Germany?
I think you have to be involved in the Middle East militarily, politically, economically.
So in other words, do the exact thing that makes us a target in the first place. That's your answer. Your answer is to create more of the problem. Now understand, that's not just my opinion. We've covered the studies before on this show. The war on terror has created more terrorists. If the goal was, when you went into it, we need to limit the number of people in the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other jihadist organizations, and that's why we're doing what we're doing here, to get revenge for 9/11 and to do that. Well, guess what? The exact opposite has happened. You want to know why? Because you went in there and killed so many people indiscriminately that you took people who were otherwise moderate and they turned to extremism because they viewed it as, well, now we need to protect ourselves against the invading army, the Americans, who killed my cousin and killed my aunt. So now I wasn't on the side of the Taliban before, but now I'm going to join them because they say that, hey, now we're just protecting our country from big bad America. Lindsay, your policy has been responsible for many of the problems that were created in the first place. As many people have rightly pointed out, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we invaded. After we invaded, they came in there. And then, do we need to give you a lesson every time when we discuss the issue of Iraq? How, if we never went in the first place and didn't de-bathify the government, then the secular Sunnis, Saddam's generals who know how to do war, would have never linked up with ISIS, the Sunni fundamentalists, to then take vast swaths of land. Remember, man, the religious lunatics are religious lunatics. They're not smart enough to do military strategy. They don't know what the fuck they're doing. But it's because Saddam's former generals, the secular Sunni Baathists, were pissed off at the Shias and America that they teamed up with them. That's why they teamed up with them, and that's how they've been so successful. And they got all their fucking Humvees and tanks. Story we did yesterday, 2,300 Humvees are now in the hands of ISIS. Guess who provided those Humvees to the Iraqi army in the first place? Us! If we never gave it to them, they wouldn't have the 2,300 Humvees. The same thing happened with Reagan and the Mujahideen in the 80s. We funded them because they were fighting the Soviet Union, and then eventually the Mujahideen became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and they fought us with the weapons we gave them. But your answer is more of the same, more of the same. You heard him. He said, quote, "You don't get out." Chuck Todd asked him, "Okay, well, how are we going to get out of there, and what's the plan for that?" Quote, "You don't get out." Hey, by the way, buddy, whatever happened to fiscal conservatism? Whatever happened to that? I mean, this is something that these guys claim to believe in. We believe in small government, except when it comes to war, then I want as big government as humanly possible, or subsidizing Wall Street with corporate welfare checks. As long as they're rich and white and they wear a suit and tie, they could raid the Treasury and take billions of dollars, and I'm on their side. So you believe in small government, except for when you don't. If it's locking up people for smoking weed or getting in, involved with reproductive choices for women, there you want gigantic government. For war, Lindsey Graham wants the biggest government that is possible. He's saying, I want to go places and not leave. So you want to waste billions, if not trillions of dollars, occupying the world. All places that we had an issue with, go in there and don't leave. Whatever happened to fiscal conservatism? Whatever happened to small government? You don't think that money's better spent here in Detroit, for example, where government officials tell us we can't afford to turn the water back on? You'd rather spend that money by setting up a fucking base in Fallujah? Get the fuck out of here, man. You're just not a smart person, Lindsay. What do you want me to tell you? That's the reality of it. He said, he started off. Everything he said there was wrong and stupid. Arm the Ukrainians. Why? Why would we arm the Ukrainians? So we can continue the proxy war with Russia in the region and further escalate the situation to where they will inevitably do something in return that will then drag us further into a conflict so we could march towards World War fucking three with Russia? Really? That's what you want to do, arm the Ukrainians. Stay in Afghanistan. Now, here's what I love about this. And this is what's so amazing about today's Republican Party. They have no clue how unpopular their ideas are. He says it like it's a brilliant thing, and he's got a horde of people behind him that are cheering him on. Yeah, stay in Afghanistan! They did a poll recently on this. You know what percentage of the American people want to stay in Afghanistan? 17%. That's fewer people than supported the Vietnam War when Vietnam was at its most unpopular point. Lindsey Graham is now cheerleading that war. Hey, why don't you cheerlead for getting back into Vietnam while we're at it? As long as we're supporting wildly unpopular wars that are totally ineffective, then why not argue for that? And by the way, why? Why would we get back in Afghanistan? Because the Taliban's going to set up Sharia and we need to protect the people. You care about Sharia all of a sudden? So let's invade Saudi Arabia. They have an official Sharia state. They behead people for sorcery and atheism and witchcraft. Women are covered from head to toe. Let's invade them. Oh, you don't want to do that because they're our oil butt buddy. All right, well, let's invade Brunei. They just implemented Sharia law last year. It's fresh there. Let's invade and stop it. Oh, you don't? You want to let them into the TPP so we could trade with them because we get cheap labor from them so we don't give a fuck that they do Sharia law? Oh, I see. So you're just a hypocrite. You just want to use American military power because you want to use American military power. And that's it. There's no morality here. He might think it's morality, but he's just an idiot who doesn't recognize that we're contradicting ourselves all over the place. And he said, go back to Iraq. And in Syria, of course, arm the rebel fighters and get with Turkey and other Sunni leaders in the region, and then we fight back against who? He doesn't even clarify that. You want to know why he doesn't clarify it? Because he can't clarify that. Because at one time he supported toppling Assad, the Shia leader, the authoritarian leader in the region. Then he flipped to, well, now we need to just fight ISIS. Well, ISIS are the people that are fighting Assad. So you went from, I want to fight Assad, to, I want to be allies with Assad. Which is it, tough guy? Which one do you believe? Who do you want to fight? No, what we should do is we should team up with other Sunnis to go in there and fight the Sunnis or the Shias, or we could fight both of them, or I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. All I know is I want more war! More war! More war! Lindsey, this is supposed to be a representative democracy. What you're arguing for is to do the exact opposite. Why the fuck would anybody vote for you? Okay. I got angry there. It's just so fucking arrogant, man. I can't take it. You know what I can't stand? I just cannot stand the assumption that people make, specifically in the Republican Party, where the idea is, of course we are supposed to be the chosen people. We're supposed to be the world policemen. We're supposed to have the right to go anywhere we want for any reason whatsoever. Why? Why? I don't believe that. Nobody should believe that. What if Greenland started acting like that? Oh, don't mind us. We're just going to invade Barbados and take it over. I hear there's a high rate of crime there. Well, it's the right thing to do. We got to stop the high crime rate. We got to go in there and fix it. Why? You have to have a standard when determining what to do when it comes to foreign policy. Here's the only standard I can think of that makes sense. You should only use military force for defensive reasons, to protect against an imminent attack against the nation. If you're not using it for that reason, shut the fuck up. Then you're probably the problem. If you're saying let's send troops to Syria and Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and Iraq and everywhere, just send it to all these places, the problem is probably you. All right, shit. I didn't mean to get all worked up. All right, let me do this Rick Perry story, then we'll take a break. I'm sweating now, man. Holy shit. Rick Perry sat down for an interview with the Washington Times, and of course he found a way to make everybody facepalm. He said, quote, I'm going to be a busy guy on day one, referring, of course, to when he's president, he thinks. from the time my hand goes off the Bible until you come to the inaugural balls, there's going to be a lot of work being done. One of the first things I would do is, obviously, I would rescind any agreement that this president will have made with Iran. These are the guys you want to vote for? He's saying, priority number one, stop peace. Now, the thing I love about Rick Perry is he's not even pretending that he read the agreement. He's saying any agreement the president will have made with Iran, will have made. He already made it, and it's available. The State Department released it. I read through the entire thing. We did multiple segments on it on the show. So it already exists. It's not like he's going to have to do it. But he's like, I obviously didn't read the one that's there now because I'm saying I don't even think it's made yet, and I'm against it no matter what. So you're admitting that no matter what the fuck it says, the piece of paper can literally say America gets 100% of it wants, 100% of what it wants, Iran gets 0% of what it wants, and Rick Perry's saying, well, I'm obviously, his words, quote, obviously going to rescind any agreement that this president will have made with Iran. See, guys, this is why I tell you repeatedly, these guys are the bad guys. These guys are the problem. Oftentimes you hear, you know, in conversation, it's like it's implicit in the conversation of like, well, come on, we all know Iran, they're the fucking bad guys. We're the good guys. We mean well, right? And that's how you have to view everything, and then we can debate from that being our framework and our starting point. No. The Democrats in America are on the record. We want peace with Iran. The Iranian government, specifically with people like Hassan Rouhani, they're on the record saying, yeah, we would like a nuclear peace deal because we want to get rid of some of these sanctions. So let's work together. Let's do this. So the Iranian government and the American government and the Democrats in the American government are like, okay, let's do this. Who's saying no? The Republicans have said repeatedly, I don't care what's in the deal. I don't care what's in it. I'm against peace. The Likud party in Israel, same thing. I'm against it. So again, tell me who the bad guys are. I'm asking you, who are the bad guys? We know who's against peace. We know who's for peace. Who are the bad guys? And by the way, you fucking numbnuts, if you read the deal, you find out very quickly, we basically get all of what we want, and they get none of what they want. All they want is the sanctions, lifted. So I guess in that respect, they do get some of what they want. But in return, we get basically everything we want. Okay, they give up any nuclear ambitions whatsoever. They have hard caps on how much they can enrich uranium to, and it's only for research purposes and for power for their power grid. And they have the IAEA up their ass 24/7, where they are constantly monitoring everything that they do. So it's not based on trust, it's based on verification. The deal is based on verification. But still, because Rick Perry hasn't read it, doesn't care to read it, he says stupid shit like this. I'm against it because I'm just against peace. Well, thank you for letting us know that. And now we know you only speak the language of violence, which is hilarious because that's what these guys accuse all, you know, Muslim leaders around the world of doing. Well, these guys are crazy. All they understand is violence. They're just like savages. You're telling us that's what you believe. You're saying, I don't care what the deal says. I'm against it. Okay, let me just give you a little bit more of what he said here because I think it's funny and it just further demonstrates how stupid he is because he gets like lost in his own thoughts here. He says, quote, if it is a regulation that is a disincentive to work, they need to be done away with. Okay, dude, you just went from I'm against peace with Iran to regulations like that. No transition, no nothing. You know, I don't like Iran, the disincentives of regulation to work. What? Oh, God. Stop talking, Rick. He's like a dumber version of George Bush. He says, you need to bring men and women to office with you. You need to bring men and women who are committed to this concept that you can't overregulate. You cannot put regulations in place and change the rules in the middle of the game. But if you change the regulations, wouldn't you be changing, the rules in the middle of the game? No, but that's the thing. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything. He's a silly person. He's the perfect example of the worst of American politics. A guy who's like a puppet that corporate America, some people prop up and say, we know he'll do our bidding, so just put him in there. Just hope he doesn't say anything too stupid to the point where he doesn't win the election. Well, sorry, guys, you pick somebody who's definitely going to lose the election. All right. All right, let me take a break here. I can't believe I started sweating as much as I am while yelling there. When we come back from the break, I got a church that believes in smoking weed. That should be fun. We'll talk about that. Rick Santorum really, really makes a fool of himself. No surprise, but I'll tell you how he does it this time around. And Rush Limbaugh weighs in on Caitlyn Jenner. Oh boy, we got a lot of conservatives weighing in on Caitlyn Jenner, and it is just as bad as you think it is. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
Soon, you have decisions to make. Where you'll live, when you'll move, and what entertainment provider to go with. Wait, that one's easy. Verizon Fios. Power your home with super fast internet and crystal clear TV picture quality. Now that's a smart move.
If you could only see the way she loves me, maybe you would understand why I feel this way when I'm alone and what I must do. If you could only see how blue her eyes can be when she says, when she says she loves me. Well, you got your reason, and you got your life, and you got your manipulation. Come down, son.
Oh, back, y'all. And let's talk about weed.
Yummy. We have some interesting news coming out of Indiana. Huffington Post reports the First Church of Cannabis has just received the classification that so many religious organizations covet, tax exemption status under Section 501c3 of the IRS code. They say, quote, the tax-exempt status means it can take full advantage of the benefits of being considered a public charity by the federal government, including the deduction of financial contributions, limits on the IRS's ability to audit the church, and being qualified to receive tax-deductible gifts, and more. Now, it actually may come as a surprise that the church is officially recognized, because churches like this in the past have been denied. So why is it that this church was approved so quickly? They explain, quote, they were formed under the state's controversial Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So, in other words, the bill that was created to discriminate against gay people is now being turned around and used for liberal ideals, like being able to smoke marijuana. Oh, yummy. That tastes good. I love it when stuff like this happens. Satanists have done this as well in places like Florida. We've covered those stories, how you'll have religious groups handing out, you know, anti-abortion material in public schools, and then the Satanists will come along and say, okay, well, we'll just hand out pro-abortion materials. And then, you know, the districts always have their hands tied, and there's like, well, look, either I allow both of them or I allow none of them. I can't, you know, pick and choose if I'm going to allow one. Genius! Absolutely genius. And what they're doing is, it's just a way to make a point. And the point is that, you know, if you're going to claim that you get special rights because of your religious ideology, well, then guess what? You just open the door to giving special rights for religious ideologies in general, which means that some people can step up and say, you know, I believe in smoking weed as a religious right, so you can't tell me I can't smoke weed. Or an argument I've made before, I have a deeply held belief against paying for war. 50% of my taxes is going to kill people overseas, so I'm just going to not pay 50% of my taxes. The argument is logically consistent. That's what you need to remember. Now, the Supreme Court, the idiots on the Supreme Court or in lower courts, they'll try to, like, you know, they try to come up with some bullshit, fake, nuanced-sounding argument where they're like, no, the religious thing can apply here, but it can't apply there. They did this with Hobby Lobby. Scalia was like, religion only matters if you're using it to block birth control. If somebody wants to do drugs because of it, they can't allow that. That's crazy. So they're trying to be nuanced, but in reality, what are they doing? They're being hypocrites. They're just contradicting themselves. Yeah, religious liberty, when it's for something I like, but if it's for something somebody else likes that I don't like, can't have it there. It's almost like they're broadcasting their idiocy to the rest of the world. Well, now it's being shoved back in their face, man. And they're saying, oh, that's what you believe? Great. Well, I believe this. I'm going to have a weed church. How you like them apples? Now, look, let's get to the main issue here, which is this. No religion should have exemptions because it's their religion. And we started going down this path a long time ago, this winding path, where people thought, in order to treat religions fairly and equally, we have to give them special rights. No, you don't. You treat them like anybody else. The most egregious example of this, again, we've spoken about this time and time again, is that in some red states, if you don't take your kid to the doctor and they die, you can get out of jail, and you can get away like you did nothing wrong if you just say, oh, I tried to faith heal. And you can't tell me I can't because that's my religion. I'm against, you know, modern medicine. I tried to faith heal. Try making an argument against going to jail if, you know, you believe in some sort of herbal remedy that's bullshit, that's not proven. If for secular reasons you didn't take your kid to the doctor and your kid died, you're going to jail if you did it in the name of a secular ideology. But what, it's better if you do it in the name of a religious ideology, if it's faith healing? There you're literally carving out special exemptions to say it's okay if you commit manslaughter, but only if it's in the name of God. How crazy are we? I mean, that's just like blithering, stupidity, like drool on yourself, low IQ, numbnuts, nonsense, okay? So I think the same kind of thing applies here, man. Why should churches get tax exemption? It's not like you're being too hard on them if they have to play by the same rules that every individual and every business in the country has to play by. You're not being too hard on them if you say, hey, we're going to treat you exactly like any other organization. You're being too kind on them if you say, because you say you believe in fairy tales and voodoo, you don't have to pay taxes. That's totally discriminatory against secular people. So I believe in facts and science. Why can't I pay no taxes? Because I believe in facts and science. No, it's only if you believe in unicorns and fairies and seven-headed dragons and stuff like that. So the dumber people get the tax breaks. Well, thank you for sharing this with me. The reality is regular churches shouldn't get tax breaks, and fucking weed churches shouldn't get tax breaks. I've said this before, I'll say it again. I don't think the people in this church should be able to smoke weed because they're religious. I think the people in this church should be able to smoke weed because they should be able to smoke weed. You should be allowed to smoke weed because we believe in freedom, not because we believe in religious freedom. There's a difference there, and it's very important. Okay, next. We go to Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum did an interview with a Philadelphia radio station, and at one point he was asked about Pope Francis and his stance on climate change. His answer is classic Rick Santorum, and it's hilarious. He said, quote, "The church has gotten it wrong a few times on science." You don't say. "We probably are better off leaving science to the scientists." Whoa. Okay, Rick. Only scientists should talk about science. Why the fuck do you weigh in on climate change and say you don't believe it? Why do you weigh in on various scientific issues and usually come out on the wrong side of said issues? Leave the science to the scientists if the person talking disagrees with me. If they agree with me, you can talk about science all they want. And also, dude, Pope Francis has a master's degree in chemistry. Remind me what kind of degree you have again? A degree in rootin' tootin' Bible buffoonery. That's Rick Santorum's degree. And by the way, can we just note for the record real quick that Rick Santorum said this, and we can now use this against him in the future? Anytime he says anything that's anti-science, immediately pull out, "Leave the science to the scientists! Leave the science to the scientists! Leave the science to the scientists!" I have a quote here from Rick Santorum, Rick. It says, "Leave the science to the scientists. You said that. You said that. Why are you talking about science now?" And also, when he said the church has gotten it wrong a few times in the past, let's use that against him, too. And next time he goes, "The Bible and Jesus and God and ah," you go, "Oh, really? But they got some things wrong, didn't they? Oh, you said that. So now you're saying it's inarguable because it's science and it's God, but you said that." He's such a silly person. I'm not done yet. He said, quote, "When we get involved with controversial and scientific theories, I think the church is not as forceful and not as credible." Pause for laughter because Rick Santorum is talking about people's credibility. Rick, the version of religion that is least credible is the one that you believe. He says, "I've said this to the Catholic bishops many times. When they get involved in agriculture policy or things like that, that are really outside of the scope of what the church's main message is, that we're better off sticking to the things that are really the core teachings of the church as opposed to getting involved in every other kind of issue that happens to be popular at the time." Right, got it. So now Rick Santorum is going to crusade for a new immigration bill that immediately gives all them citizenship. He wants more food stamps. He wants a better social safety net. He wants to raise the minimum wage. He wants to care about the poor, the sick, and the downtrodden. Oh, he doesn't want that. That's weird. So why are you ranting about how, you know, the church should stick to churchly things and Christian things? Let's do that. Let's, like, follow Jesus as opposed to talking about science and shit. All right, so get us out of the wars. Jesus is a pacifist. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. That means if you hit him on one side, he presents his other cheek, says, hit me there too. That's going to be your policy now towards Syria, right? ISIS hits us. You go, it's all right. Don't worry. We're pulling out. We're going home. We're going to go have some Taco Bell. No, you're not going to do that. You know you're not going to do that. the thing is, a guy like Rick Spencer, he just has verbal diarrhea all day, fucking verbal diarrhea all over the place. When it suits his argument, science, leave the science to the scientists. You know what, buddy? Agreed, let's do that. Take a look at this chart here. Whoopsie-daisy, Rick. See, what is this? Well, this is the peer-reviewed studies on climate change over a very long time span there, as you can see. And what is it? 99.8%, 99.9% of all of the peer-reviewed scientific studies on climate change say it's real and it's man-made and we must do something about it. That little sliver of red is the only are the only studies that say no. Over 13,000 studies. And only fucking 0.01 or 0.1% or whatever the fuck it is say no, 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 it's not real. Every other one, so even when liberals say 97% of climate scientists believe in it, even that's outdated. This is more accurate because it's the studies themselves, the peer-reviewed studies. So I guess in conclusion, Rick, I agree. Let's go with the with what the scientists say on the issue of science. So namely, let's go with the opposite of everything you've ever said and advocated for. All right, next. All right, we got to go to Rush Limbaugh now. How many stories do I have left? One, two, okay. I got to speed up a little bit. Rush Limbaugh went on a hilarious rant about Caitlyn Jenner, formerly Bruce Jenner. Let's listen.
To redefine normalcy has another component to it, which is to redefine the new weirdos. And that's us, folks. Conservatives and Republicans are the new weirdos, the new kooks. And that is part of the political objective here in normalizing all of this really marginal behavior. I mean, if less than 1% of the population is engaging in it, it's marginalized behavior. It isn't normal. No matter how you define it. But the quest to make it normal contains with it the objective to make the people who might disapprove of it or the people who don't do it weirdos and kooks. And that's where the Republican branding problem resides, because the objective here has been to portray the old norms and the practitioners of the old norms as the deadbeats, the dry balls, the sticks in the mud, or worse, the racist, sexist, bigot, homophobes. But they're the weirdos. And all of this other behavior, however you want to describe it, is celebrated now as a new norm, and we need to have a conversation about it. And the reason we need to have a conversation is to rip and criticize the arbiters of the old norms, which happens to be religion, Christianity, conservatism, republicanism, you name it. Do not doubt me on this.
Oh, yes, I know. Master Rush, we never doubt you. Everything you say is gospel. I love how he treats his listeners, his followers. Contrast that with what I tell you guys all the time. I want you to have up Google and to fact-check me as I do my show, because I want what I say to be true. He's like, don't doubt me! Don't doubt me on this! I know I'm right. Okay, so now understand what his argument is there. He's saying, with this whole Caitlyn Jenner situation, the real victims of transgender discrimination, the real victims in this entire scenario, Republicans. I love how these guys always talk about liberals as if we have a victim complex. Like, yeah, liberals always love to play the victim. That's why they're victim culture, victim culture. Rush Limbaugh's entire show is based on Democrats suck, Republicans are the victims. Everything he's ever argued is like that. So it's a clear example of projection. He looks at Caitlyn Jenner's situation and says, yeah, this is really unfair to conservatives, is what it is. God, you're such a myopic douche. You're insufferable. And understand, he also goes on in the clip, too, to talk about how, you know, it's our lifestyle's under attack and, you know, they want to change the way we do shit. No, Rush, it's not about you. Nobody's knocking on your door, hey, Rush, open up, and saying, I'm going to force you to be trans. Nobody's doing that. Nobody's doing that. The only argument we're making is give trans people equal rights and don't be a dick. That's it, but of course he takes issue with that. Now, he's not done yet.
you earlier. A couple of short passages from a blog. I didn't identify the blog, but I told you it's a conservative Republican blog. I'm going to quote it again, because it proves the point that I just made to you. With the momentum from this announcement and affiliation, Caitlyn Jenner inadvertently gave the Republican Party something it really, really desperately needs. Street cred. Simply put, an understanding sense of humanity. So here we have a conservative blog celebrating the fact because Caitlyn Jenner has identified as a Republican. This is great news for us because this is going to show people that we're human and that we've got credibility. And look, at here you have a transgender who feels totally at home in the Republican Party. And this is written about here as a big plus for us. Why is this a big plus? It's a big plus because whoever wrote this is of the belief that all the criticism of us, racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, oddball, weirdball, is true.
Yes, because it is. Whatever conservative wrote that is a better conservative and a smarter person than you. The person realizes if you look at the statistics, yes, the overwhelming majority of trans people and gay people and all the different minority groups are Democrats. Why are they Democrats? Because they're not stupid. They realize the Democratic Party represents them more and actually gives a shit about them, whereas the Republicans do not. But Rush acts like, you know, it's outrageous to say that Bruce Jenner being Republican is good for Republicans because it changes the image of Republicans. How outrageous is that? This guy's assuming that we're not on the side of trans people. And then in the rest of the clip, he goes on to prove that he's not on the side of trans people. He does the same thing with gay people, too. I'm not intolerant. The liberals are intolerant for not tolerating my intolerance. Stop trying to flip it, dude. It's the oldest argument in the world, and you sound like a child. Now, here's what it comes down to, man. Rush, you and many Republicans, not all of them, but most Republicans, judge the fuck out of gay people and people like Bruce Jenner. Caitlyn Jenner now. Because of your religion. So you judge them nonstop. You just judge. You never have anything positive to say about these people. And then you're surprised when, you know, most of them are Democrats. And you act like you don't have a problem. No, the problem is because of your religion and because of your beliefs, you refer to it, you're weird, we don't want to have anything to do with you. And then also, whenever there's a bill that comes up, like an anti-discrimination bill, for example, for trans people, it's you guys who are against it. It's not Mitch McConnell and John Boehner who are like, you know, today, after we do tax cuts for Wall Street again, let's work on that that bill for the transgender community. That would be fantastic. They don't do that. And if something comes up in favor of trans people, they're against it. So when people describe you as not, by and large, not being on the side of trans people, it is accurate. But this is Rush Limbaugh's show in a nutshell. He's been doing it for decades now. You know, Republicans are always right. We're the good people by definition. Everybody should be a Republican, even if we're on the record as being against your community, you should vote Republican, and if you don't, fuck you. I mean, I'm not sure in the decades he's been on air, he's ever made a convincing argument to anybody who stops and thinks about it for about 5 minutes. All right, next. Alex McFarland is a Christian apologist, and I don't say that disparagingly. That's literally how he refers to himself on his website. And McFarland went on the American Family Association's conservative hate radio to talk about Caitlyn Jenner.
God would not make us a certain way and then demand that we not be that way. When people have gender confusion, as is so prevalent in our community, in our country right now, and there's so much moral, the lines of gender have been blurred, that's not God. We don't blame that on God. Let me say this. Homosexuality, same-sex attraction, gender confusion is a means of trying to deal with pain. When I look at a Bruce Jenner, I see a person that I know. My graduate training in developmental psychology, my time as a pastor, Tim and Ray. I know this is a person who's hurting. It's very sad. But, you know, I've got to say this, and I want you guys to respond to this. I believe the whole transgender, someone trying to change their sexuality, it's the ultimate form of moral relativism, because it's saying, God, you have no control on me. God, you have no claim on my life, not even over my gender.
Mm-hmm.
What could be more personal than our gender, maleness and femaleness? It's down to our very chromosomes. And when Bruce Jenner, he was on CNN a month ago, and he said that he's got the soul of a woman, that's demonic.
That's demonic. That's demonic. I always want to ask guys like this. That's what Satan's doing. That's what the devil's doing. That's what demons are doing. You would think, okay, first of all, there's no evidence demons exist. So let's get that out of the way. No evidence. But even if they did exist, wouldn't they be more, you know, in the earthquake game, the tsunami game, the let me crash this plane game, you know, the let's make people starve to death, let's spread fucking Ebola, let's do this, let's do that. Or let's just directly kill people. If you're a demon, you're supernatural. All you got to do is dead. That's it. Just look at somebody. Dead. You're gone. But no, the way a demon manifests itself is, I'm going to make this male think that they're female. Which is what? That's not even a bad thing. That's just not even a bad thing. It's just different from what most people experience. So most people are male, they feel male, or they're female and they feel female, and people are either attracted to the opposite sex or the same sex or whatever. It's just a little different. And there's plenty of people who feel like that too. That's how a demon manifests itself. That's as ridiculous as a demon saying, I, the demon, will make Dave in Idaho crave a ham sandwich today. But there's nothing wrong with that. There's no problem with that. I mean, but see, look at how much they've let go of rationality. Because think about how many layers deep that stupid point goes. There's a trillion assumptions that are untrue in just that little comment. The assumption is demons exist, my religion is true, my interpretation of my religion is true, and demons are not causing tsunamis or giving people fucking strokes and heart attacks. They're changing people's perception of their gender. So stupid. And then I like the very beginning. I don't know if you caught it. He basically said, well, God wouldn't make you anything but what you are. Yeah. That's our point. Here's a person who was born biologically male, knew his entire life, well, I'm really a she. My brain is female. I'm female in every real sense other than what my fucking private parts are. That's what I am. So if God made Caitlyn Jenner like that, who the fuck are you to judge, big guy, unless you're disagreeing with God? Do you disagree with God? Why do you hate God? And finally he says, but this is not a person, this is a person that's hurting. The concern trolling that Brian Fisher did the other day, too. My response to this is, yeah, Bruce Jenner of the past was hurting tremendously. You want to know why? Because he was lying to himself and saying, I am Bruce Jenner, when he always knew, I'm a she and I'm Caitlyn Jenner. So, yeah, he was hurting because he was pretending to be he, when he was really she. He was Caitlyn Jenner. Gonna feel a lot better now. So spare me your fake concern. It all comes down to your religion. It all comes down to trying to force people into your rigid understanding of what gender is and what sex is. Take a hike, man. This fundamentalist garbage belongs in the year 1232, not in 2015. All right, now let's go to Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson, Demon Hunter, is back to respond to his psycho audience and their questions. Let's watch.
All righty. Well, Joyce says, dear Pat, many years ago when I was a young mother, I bought a Ouija board.
Oh.
At the time, I didn't know any better.
Mm.
I thought it was just a fun game.
No,
when I learned that it is evil, I got rid of it. Now my son has grown and full of hatred and mental issues. I have been through so much heartache because of his mental condition. I've prayed and prayed for his healing, but no change so far. Do you think God is punishing me for exposing my son to demons when he was young?
I don't know if God's punishing you, but you can't open the door to demons. And demons, you know, there was one lady I heard about who was demon-possessed, and the demon was being cast out, and the demon said, I had permission.
Mm-hmm.
And permission was that this particular person had gone to a X-rated movie and had, you know, gotten all of these sex things. And the demon said, I had permission. So you gave the demons permission to come into your home when you had a Ouija board. Look, mental illness has many forms. I don't know what's wrong with your son. I mean, it may be neurological. It may be something psychological. He may need professional help. But at the same time, he may need to get delivered. And I don't know him, but there are all those things you need to take into consideration. And then do. But he needs an intervention. Get something to help him.
But
right.
Even if she opened the door, she can repent, ask for forgiveness.
Absolutely.
In the net.
Close the door and send
the
demon away. But you have to come and say, hey, Lord, I repent. And that demon, you do not have permission anymore. I take away that permission, and I cast you forth from my son. You need to speak those words.
Because the demon is supernatural and obviously has way more powers than you do. But somehow, if you just say the right words, they go, damn, you schooled me. I'm going to take my demon ass away now. Well done. I concede. It's a demon. You don't have the powers it has, but somehow if you make the right sounds with your mouth, it goes, oh, I concede. You got me. I love how they have these conversations in a very, like, serious tone. Like, okay, demons, let's talk about this. So you say, what happened with your son again? I got to give you the right prescription, the right prayer here, and let's fix this. Dude, 2015... The year is 2015. This guy's on TV. This guy's on TV. We live in a world where we have the internet. We have phones. I can call somebody in fucking Dusseldorf right now. I could be on the phone with somebody in Dusseldorf in a minute. We have that kind of technology. We have vaccines. We've been to the fucking moon. But people still watch Pat Robertson. Oh, the demons. I'll save the demons. I'm going to help you with the demons. I'm such a powerful, strong preacher. I'm like 83 years old, and I just shit myself, but I'm a strong man. Let me help you pray out the demons. You're a fucking con man, dude. That's what you are. You're a con man. He said, well, the Ouija board is demonic. Actually, she said that in the letter. The Ouija board is demonic that I bought years ago. Is that why my kid's a dick? No, chances are you are the reason why your kid is a dick. You sound like a crazy person. I would be a dick, too, if I was your son, because I'd be like, oh, my God, is this really my mother? This is the fucking, these are the people that I'm stuck with? This fucking idiot who just thinks a Ouija board affects my personality? Your parenting affected my personality, asshole! A Ouija board. A fucking Ouija board. I told you, Pat Robertson always talks about Dungeons and Dragons and Harry Potter, and Jerry Falwell used to talk about the Teletubbies and how, that one's gay, stay away, the gay demons inside of him. Oh. This is what they believe, man. And this is what they talk about. Best part by far is when he said, well, yeah, I was talking to a demon inside somebody. Sure you were. And they said the X-rated demons got a hold of the person when they seen an X-rated movie. Pat, if watching adult films means that demons have gotten inside of you, for fuck's sake, Gog and Magog are having a picnic in my intestines right now. No, if X-rated movies led to demon possession, all of us are demon possessed. You're demon possessed. I can see fucking Beelzebub popping out of your earlobe if fucking X-rated movies lead to demon possession. Look at this, man. Again, 2015, we got people who are anti-porn. Who's anti-porn? You can't look at the titties and the butts on the screen and pleasure yourself, because that's wrong. Why is it wrong? Nobody's getting hurt. The porn actors are paid. It doesn't seem like a big deal. If Jesus says it's wrong, he don't like it if you have pleasure in your life. So that's what it comes down to. So religion is anti-pleasure. Ooh! You guys argue anti-pleasure all day long. Us secular people will argue on the side of pleasure. Let's see who wins. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Have a good one. Peace.